This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith with Steve Shoemaker. Steve is still on his extended vacation in Alaska. He will be returning next weekend to this show. My name is Don Nolan. I've been filling in for Steve for the past month, and we are this afternoon going to focus on the topic of Mennonite faith and life, and we're very privileged to have with us a very new addition to our community, Pastor Janet Rasmussen, who is the new pastor of the First Mennonite Church in Urbana. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for inviting me, Don.
We are going to talk about all things Mennonite and issues and history and theology and a whole host of things this afternoon. Want to let our listeners know that this is a call-in show, and you are encouraged and welcome to call in with any questions or comments that you'd like to make about our topic or with our guests this afternoon. Our number is 333-9455, or you can also call 1-800-222-9455. Well, Pastor Rasmussen, or may I call you Janet?
Please call me Janet.
Janet, you are almost as brand new as you can get. How long have you been here?
I arrived to take up my call on the 1st of May.
And you have a very interesting background, and I thought we'd talk a little bit about how you came to this particular denomination and to this church relatively late in life, although you obviously are very young. You have had a previous career. You want to tell us a little bit about where you were posted before you went into the ministry and divinity school?
I would be delighted to give you a little sense of my journey. I do want to begin, if it's all right, Don, just by mentioning that I have come back to my roots in central Illinois, and I feel very blessed by that, as well as blessed by my pastoral call. I grew up in Paxton, Illinois, just 30 miles to the north, and did my undergraduate work here at the University of Illinois, graduating with a degree in English.
Mm-hmm.
This was at the time of the Vietnam War.
Ah.
I went off to...
60s.
Right. I graduated in 1970 and went off to pursue a PhD in the field of technically Germanic languages and literatures. It was humanities study, and my particular interest was the languages, literature, and culture of the Scandinavian countries. I did my PhD at Harvard and began my career in higher education when I completed that degree, doing teaching first at Harvard and some administrative work, and then moving among a variety of private institutions, first as a faculty member and then working as an academic administrator.
And you taught Scandinavian languages?
I taught the Norwegian language.
The Norwegian language.
Yes.
For how long?
Well, you could say that that part of my career lasted for close to 20 years, but really about 15. It sort of divides into two parts, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had, by that time, become a dean and was recruited to be an academic vice president, and then served for 5 years as president of a college in Roanoke, Virginia.
What was the college?
It's called Hollins University.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small liberal arts campus with undergraduate programs for women and co-ed graduate programs.
How large was that?
It's only about 1,100 students, so it's really at the other end of the continuum from a place like the University of Illinois.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you crossed over to the dark side, as we in the faculty sometimes say, but now you have come back in a very different sort of way. How did you move from there, obviously a very successful career in higher education, to become a pastor?
You know, like a lot of people, I think, there was a time in midlife when I began to really take much more time to evaluate my inner life and to ask whether I had been paying enough attention to how God was leading me in my journey to complement, perhaps to stand in opposition to, the voices that I was hearing naturally as part of a busy professional career. And when you are on the fast track in whatever field it is, it's pretty easy, especially when you know you are involved in important work, as folks in education are, to simply keep trudging along and to take the next opportunity that comes without that time of reflection and community discernment, which is one of the, of course, roles of the church. So for me to sort of step back and do that was very key. I had some close friendships, too, that helped me with that sort of discernment that said there's something missing here, and what might it be? And whether there is something that God is calling me to do that I had not perceived fully. And part of my discovery when I took a sabbatical and then returned to the Pacific Northwest, where I had previously served on the faculty, and absorbed the impact of 9/11 and the response to that in our nation, was to recognize that my commitment to peacemaking was very deep, a cord that had been part of my life and part of my work in the international education arena, working with students and the like, and to take that commitment to if you will, marry that to what was a strong spiritual hunger, and to find through wonderful friend evangelism, and I believe strongly in friend evangelism, that the Mennonite Church provided me a home to really develop my understanding of the gospel of peace.
This was in the Pacific Northwest?
This was in the Pacific Northwest, and I became a member of Seattle Mennonite Church.
I see.
So in that context, the context of that community, while I was also doing administrative work in higher education, I had just deliberately took the time to do that self-examination and to also then, in community, ask questions about what might I be called to.
Now, were you involved in a religious tradition before you came to the University of Illinois back in the 60s?
I was a very, very active, as was my family, in the Methodist Church, and that was my denominational affiliation up until the time I formally joined the Mennonite Church. I also had lots of opportunities to relate to Lutherans because I served for many years at Pacific Lutheran University on the faculty and as an administrator. And working with the Scandinavian countries, it was also very natural that Lutheranism became also sort of part of my profile, if you will.
Now, you mentioned friend evangelism. Describe that a little bit.
For me, friend evangelism is the opportunity. In this case, it was a fellow college president, the president of one of the Mennonite colleges, Goshen College in Elkhart, in Goshen, Indiana. Goshen and Elkhart are side by side, who became such a close friend, and we were sharing a lot spiritually. And when she recognized that I was not finding a fit with a church that could actually, from my perspective, walk the talk, she encouraged me. She said, why don't you go to Seattle Mennonite?
Had you tried Methodist churches?
I went back. When I returned to the Pacific Northwest, I went back to my Methodist church there and also visited several others. For me, at that point, I was not hearing, for me, an unequivocal message which related to how we might be responding in a time of grave concern, grave crisis, obviously.
9/11 played a significant role in your change in career, or was that just a further catalyst?
I think it was a further catalyst. It was not that at that point I was already on a journey to say where was I headed and what was God leading me to.
Apparently, that that date has changed a whole lot of careers, not just as a catalyst, but turn people's lives to other directions.
Well, it was part two of my last assignment in higher education at mm-hmm. Pacific Lutheran University, because an alumnus originally from China gifted the university with a multimillion-dollar gift in the wake of 9/11, saying we must do a better job of educating for peace. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to lead that center's development, which was what I was doing also. So really, my work in higher education at that point was very much focused on education for peace, even mm-hmm. as I was then deepening my understanding of the Mennonite peace position.
Was this this project in the general category of peacemaking initiatives, or just to work within the United States with denominations to talk about peace? What was the project?
No, the project at Pacific Lutheran University really had several prongs, one of which was public programs and symposia that developed international and intercultural understanding, international study and service projects for students, which already were very strong there, as they are here at the U of I, but it was an opportunity then to put all those under the umbrella of what it means to educate.
I see. Mm-hmm. Now, from there, you went on to seminary?
To seminary.
Where'd
to
you
seminary.
Go?
I went to our Mennonite Seminary in Elkhart, Indiana. Right. I thought it was very important that I have the opportunity to study in one of our own denominational seminaries, since I was coming to the tradition mm-hmm. As a older in life adult and needed to have that specific grounding. And I was very well served by my 3 years there. Mm-hmm. I graduated with a Master of Divinity degree in May.
In May?
Mm-hmm.
My.
Just when I took up my call.
And did you have a focus in seminary?
My focus was called Theological Studies with an emphasis on peace and justice.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And what are the more interesting initiatives going on out there in that area? There are a lot of new things that I've seen emerging within various denominations in peace and justice studies. Are you hoping to go in a particular direction in that now growing field?
Well, at First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana, part of the congregational visioning process over the last years has been to affirm that the establishment of a peace and justice initiative, sort of claiming that and naming that for our congregation and being intentional about how we might contribute to the larger dialogue and activism in our community has been central. And clearly it was one of several strands that made this call seem like just the perfect match.
Now, is your focus going to be international, local, national, or do those distinctions not make a difference in what you're focusing on?
As I understand the work in our congregation and otherwise, it really is kind of an unfortunate distinction we sometimes make between the local and the global. Mm-hmm. We are called to work in our neighborhoods, mm-hmm. Where we live and reside, but we also are called to care for our brothers and sisters around the world. And so it's not an either or, and I have not seen that in any way in our congregation. We have a very fine sister church relationship in our congregation with a church, happens to be a Lutheran church. This was established well before I came, called El Divino Redentor in Bucaramanga, Colombia. Mm-hmm. And that outreach and sister church relationship is very important to us as a way of being in solidarity mm-hmm. With Christians who are finding themselves surrounded by violence, displacement, obviously poverty, and some persecution. So for us to walk with them is very significant. So we're working there, and we also have various local initiatives.
I think there's one of them we'll talk about a little bit later. You also have a relationship with the CIMIC, Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center. Isn't that right?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. There are neighbors in the literal sense.
Across the street.
They are mm-hmm. just down the block from us. And when their building was erected just down Lincoln Avenue obviously they became important to our congregation, and there have been relationships that have been established for quite some time. Those took on a greater urgency after 9/11. Mm-hmm. One of the initiatives that predated 9/11, that just is a neighborly gesture that has been very significant, is that they use our parking lot for their Friday prayers and have offered their parking lot to us. And if that may seem like a small thing, but, you know, it has to do with how we honor each other's worshiping communities and our good neighbors with each other. We have had many types of back and forth with some conscious dialogue engagements, small dinners, visits. I hosted a tea as a reciprocity for hospitality I received when I came as a call candidate to the area. So we are now ready. I hear from those who have been part of this dialogue and friendship evolving
for some years.
For right? some years, that it seems now that we're ready to actually perhaps take on some kind of a joint project. Mm-hmm. So we've begun to think about that together, and that's very exciting. So again, this to me is a point of great energy for us as a congregation, that we can demonstrate what it means to be working for reconciliation.
Right. Let me just remind our listeners, you can call in. This is a call-in show, and if you'd like to ask a question of Pastor Janet Rasmussen, who is the brand new pastor at the Mennonite Church here in Urbana, feel free to call in. The numbers are 333-9455. You can also call 1-800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here on line four. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question?
Yes, I do. Very enjoyable conversation. Your guest mentioned that it was 9/11 that had caused her, I believe, to do a turnabout in her thinking. And I was just wondering, what was it maybe more specifically about that? And had she had any previous contact with the Anabaptist Mennonite faith, and especially in its concept of peace before that time?
Janet?
Well, thank you for the question. Chance for me to clarify a bit more what I was referring to there. Yes, I had had contacts with the Mennonites, again, especially through interpersonal relationships, which, of course, I think are very significant, and knew in a, you might say, a more general or vague sense about the broader Anabaptist community, even just growing up here in central Illinois, but not with any depth of understanding. The move that I was on a track in terms of this urgency with respect to listening, putting God at the center of my life and listening in terms of where I was being led. But the events of 9/11 with the variety of responses as to how we should act at that point caused me to feel an urgency about making a stand on behalf of a nonviolent response.
Does that address your question, caller?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. Why don't we talk a little bit about 9/11? Do you think that, as some said at the time, that this was a culture-changing event, or do you think that it has slipped far enough into the past that not much has changed in our society? How do you understand the meaning of 9/11, having had such an emotional response to it in your own thinking?
Put
it this way, what does 9/11 mean now?
What does 9/11 mean now? Mm-hmm. Right. I want to say to start that the violence that pervades our society, you know, is part of the reality that we live with. Mm-hmm. And for us as citizens and residents of the United States to experience the kind of violence exerted against our territory, you know, our institutions, in the way that so many nations, peoples, locales around the world have experienced that level of grave violence over centuries. For us to have that experience was, for me, an opportunity for us to be in solidarity mm-hmm. with others and to stand up against violence and that way of trying to make any points to solve anything. So it did change, I think, our psyche here in the sense of opening up for us to claim a special vulnerability and for us to succumb to fear, which is exactly what the Bible calls us not to do. We are called by Jesus to not be afraid, mm-hmm. to trust, and to walk in that way of peaceful trusting. So at that level, we have had all of this violence in our lives, and we haven't necessarily developed good strategies for dealing with it. But we then had this very grave expression of violence against us. And we could respond in one way, and as a nation, we responded in another.
Yeah. Let's come back to that in just a couple of minutes. I wanted to, before we left talking about you, talk with you a little bit about how you have been able to merge your interests and what you've learned in your previous career with this career. I'm sure there's all kinds of overlap. Lots of people have and are contemplating career change. How has your academic and administrative life informed or given meaning to your most recent career change?
Right. Well, any of your listeners who are involved with education, or of course as parents too, will recognize that the focus on human development and human flourishing is at the heart of what educators do, who are called into that wonderful service profession, and that's how I look at it, at whatever level it is, to be able to develop human potential, to seek to do that in a holistic way. And certainly at the heart of good university work with a broad liberal arts core, arts and sciences core, that kind of holistic attention to human development and flourishing is there. So to be able to take that long-standing commitment about who I am and what I care about, and to bring that into a congregational setting, into the church, where we can be very explicit about the spiritual dimensions, where we can walk with people through crises, where we can celebrate with them some of their greatest joys. We can walk with people in the last days of their lives. And we practice what it means to love each other, you know, in a very profound way, has been remarkable for me. And so I see a transfer and I see a deepening as an enormous mm-hmm. privilege as a pastor.
The academic life historically in this country has attempted to separate the public professional from the private, at least with students. Did you feel frustrated at all during your academic careers with this desire on your part to do something more holistic in working with students' development? I know that I've had those concerns as well, students coming to you with existential problems, even psychiatric issues
right.
that require professional counseling. But as a pastor, you approach that very differently than you would as a professor or an administrator, right?
That's right. And, you know, on campuses, we have a cadre of professionals to deal, as you point out, with psychological and emotional issues. We have of chaplains and religious leaders who are at the ready to assist students. But there is a tendency to do some compartmentalizing. You're right. By the same token, I think good mentors, good academic mentors, are sensitive, just as you would be, just as you are sensitive as a dean or supervisor, academic vice president, to the lives of faculty, and that these are that you can't separate what's happening at home with what's happening on the job in terms of individuals and their capacity to work and to flourish themselves.
You seem so. This is the second time I've met you, and you seem to be awfully excited and enthusiastic about this appointment. Maybe it's just in your personality, but you look like you have a lot of joy in this new
appointment. Yes, I do. You know, I brought along today my first Bible, and Don can see it, and the rest of you can't. It's just a little New Testament. Looks pretty worn. It was given to me when I was 8 years old, and the marvelous thing is that a mystery resides in its covers. And I want to call attention to this because perhaps there are folks listening out there who are wondering if they're being called to something new. And I discovered this after I had gone to seminary, actually, but it confirmed that I was on the right path. I had written my name and a date when I was 10 years old, and I had underlined underneath that and written the word pastor. And I have no idea where that came from. I just know that there was some sense of urging or possibility. And I had never at that point in my life had any acquaintance with a woman pastor. We had never had a woman pastor. I had not seen, I don't think I'd even seen a woman usher in our church growing up.
Where'd you grow up?
Paxton, Illinois.
Paxton, right.
And, it was a long time. For most, even the mainline denominations, this was starting to happen in the Methodist Church about this time. So maybe there was some inkling out there. I was never encouraged in any direction like that. Mm-hmm. So something that would have seemed really impossible, very unlikely, has now sort of come and emerged for me to say, how is God using all of what has been part of my life
right now
to provide me with an incredible opportunity to serve.
My grandfather would say that you've come full circle. I don't know if you feel that or not.
I do. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about who Mennonites are. There are a lot of stereotypes, associations many people have. What is the origin of the Mennonite tradition, and how did it come by that name?
All right. We have to go back to the early 16th century in Central Europe to the time of the Reformation. And so those in the audience who are familiar with Martin Luther and John Calvin will have some sense of that era, that time period, and the ferment that was underway as a response to dominant practices in what was really a single expression of Christianity in the official form as it was presented then. And alongside these well-known Reformation reformers that become part of the mainline Protestant traditions, there was a small group who became known as Anabaptists. And the Anabaptists got their name because Anna meant again. And part of the specific platform for these reformers, as opposed to Luther and Calvin and others, was a real desire to separate church and state.
Now that, didn't this have something to do with thinking of this movement as a third way or an alternative to?
Yes, as an alternative to either the Roman Catholic Church or the other protest movements from the Catholic Church that were emerging.
It's still part of the Protestant evolution. Is that how do Mennonites? think of themselves?
You know, you hear it both ways. You hear it, some saying neither mm-hmm. Protestant nor Catholic, and others would say, yes, of course, it's part of the broader mm-hmm. Protestant body. Certainly, that would be how we would think of it today. But there is a phrase called the Radical Reformation, and by this sense, the radical really meant that these reformers felt there was no purpose for the state to be determining membership in a church, for example, that we were called to make a voluntary commitment to our loyalty to Jesus Christ. And that voluntary commitment would be signaled by baptism. And so if baptism was administered to infants simply as a routine, as a part of being born and registered into a government entity, a city or a province, then that was really a co-option by the state, and there wasn't an opportunity for that sense of the individual commitment to follow Christ. That's why the Anabaptist label came to be used. It was considered a great treachery that someone would be rebaptized. There were probably 5,000 Anabaptists altogether.
By the Roman Catholic Church. So what you
right.
mean, treachery?
Right. Because you were considering invalid what right. you know what had been already done, and so many of these early reformers were tried for heresy, were killed, martyred for their faith, and there was a lot of persecution going on. So thousands died as a part of this movement. There's a story that, you know, the leaders are part of this notion of lay leadership comes from the fact that there were, you know, someone had to be ready to take over because you didn't know whether the next time you met out in the woods or in someone's home, whether, you know, the person had been designated as the leader would have been taken off to prison mm-hmm. and perhaps killed. So it was a real commitment on the part of these individuals, an extreme commitment that they were making. There was also at the same time a focus on, as with the other reformers, but specific focus on reading the Scripture, having direct access to the Scripture, and being involved in interpreting the Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, there are several offshoots or developments out of the Anabaptist tradition. One is the Amish.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
What else?
Mm-hmm. The Amish are part of that. There's a group called the Hutterites, which are known for common ownership of goods. It's a very small group now. The Amish are probably those who are best known. Within the Mennonites themselves, there are sort of some multiple varieties, if you will. There's an old order Mennonite branch that believes, like the Amish, in maintaining certain kinds of visible markers of being not of this world.
And because of the persecutions in many countries, many of them found their way over to the United States.
Yes.
And what's the history of the Mennonite tradition there?
Well, the Mennonites came to, I'm going to say North America, because many also came to Canada, and there has been a real sense of kind of the relationships across those two nations over the years. The first Mennonites came to, I think it was Germantown in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we think of Pennsylvania with the Quakers, but there was a strong Mennonite presence and remains a very strong Mennonite presence.
It's the largest
presence.
Population in the states, right? In
right.
the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So those who came from the Swiss-German background often settled there and moved then west. There were also a number of Mennonites who found their way to the Ukraine. And that is a separate movement that came later, much later, of course, at the beginning of the 20th century, where mm-hmm. they came after
persecution. And the Mennonite church here in Urbana how would you situate it within the historical tradition?
You know, our church is very interesting. We were founded in 1964. We were founded, in a sense, as an offshoot of the Mennonite Church in Fisher, which is called East Bend Mennonite Church, as an outreach and witness to students and also to the professionals in this community. And from the beginning, we were what was called a dual affiliate congregation, which meant that we were related to both branches of what were then two separate denominations, the General Conference and what's now called the Old Mennonite Church. And those bodies merged in 1995. Uh-huh. And so we have had, or they had a joint confession of faith in 1995 and have been working and worked toward a merger. So we have always had a fairly diverse group in our congregation and have welcomed many, like myself, who did not grow up Mennonite. For many Mennonites, because of this background, because they then settled out in agricultural communities, believed in living a fairly simple life, there was a tendency for them to be known as the quiet in the land, not necessarily to be developing churches beyond their local communities. And that has changed dramatically. Now, as a worldwide church body, we have more Mennonites, not surprisingly, to these days in the global south than we have in the global north. Our largest Mennonite churches are in Ethiopia.
Is that right?
Yeah. Hmm. Mm-hmm. So the sense of kind of global connection is very strong for Mennonites today. And the opening up of and the welcoming of new churches, most of our church growth in this country comes from Hispanics and other immigrants, actually.
Just a reminder, this is a call-in show, and we're talking with Pastor Janet Rasmussen, who is a brand-new pastor of the First Mennonite Church in Urbana. We're talking about the Mennonite tradition, and soon I hope we'll talk a little bit about some issues, theological and political and social issues. If you'd like to call in with some questions for Pastor Rasmussen or comments, call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Now, you had mentioned that you mentioned earlier separation of church and state. As I'm sure you're well aware, there's a great deal of controversy about how to conceive of that, and some challenges to it, some even subversive affirmations of it, but not actually affirming it. The Mennonite tradition probably in the United States has a stronger commitment to a stronger separation than other traditions that even within the Protestant faith, even perhaps more so than Southern Baptist or Baptist in general. Isn't that right?
I'm not probably the right person to make comparative statements on this, but I'd be happy to speak and from what I understand about our position. And yes, indeed, there is a strong sense that the Christian nation, I'll use that phrase, is the church, that is the only Christian nation, and that we must be clear about the fact that we owe respect to our government, and there is a role for government and all the rest, but it does not replace in any way our loyalty and the lordship of Jesus Christ and our loyalty to the church. I think it's very, very strong in the tradition.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Hello, I have a question. First I have a comment. I've read a lot of Beverly Lewis's novels. She's an Amish writer. And I was just wondering, are the Mennonite services in English?
Thank you for that question. I'm not familiar by having read her work, but I am familiar with her. I know she's quite popular and is depicting Amish life, and I know many people are really enjoying her novels. So thank you for mentioning those.
You're welcome.
The Mennonite services are in English, except here in Urbana-Champaign. Of course, some of the Amish services have continue to draw on the old hymn books and the use of the Low German. That's part of that tradition. So it's really it is important to make that distinction. I'm not an expert on the Amish. We use a church building. We have a worship service that is not highly liturgical, but would be recognizable in all of its component parts to, you know, anyone just coming in from another Christian tradition. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your comment. We have another caller on line two. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You got a
question? Hello there. I am from Rankin, Illinois. I was born and raised there. But I have a question for the pastor. I will hang up after my question. Could you explain to me a little bit about the doctrinal beliefs of the Mennonites and their view on Israel? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you for your question.
Well, the doctrinal beliefs, let me be as succinct as I can. Of course, like many denominations, we have a fairly elaborate confession of faith, which guides us and is helpful to us. But we are Trinitarians. We believe in God, the God Father, God the Father, Jesus Christ, the Word of God, and the Holy Spirit. We are very much taking the Bible quite seriously in our congregation. I think we would say that we do not take it literally, but we take it very seriously. And we take very seriously what is the revelation that comes from reading the Bible in community, using community discernment, with the Holy Spirit, and looking at the full trajectory of the biblical narrative from Genesis to Revelation, and asking what it is we are learning about God's work and our call to be reconcilers, the vision of universal peace that is very strong, whether it's in the prophetic voices of the Old Testament or there at the end of Revelation, and recognizing that Jesus and his teachings play a key role in our understanding that. So we take very seriously how we are to follow Jesus' teaching. Discipleship is very key. And probably of all the New Testament texts, the Sermon on the Mount stands in a special position in that regard. So I hope that helps a bit in terms of just setting a context for us. To my knowledge, there is, I'm trying to think if I can refer to a specific statement on the state of Israel, which is the other part of your question, as I understand it, or perhaps you mean it in a little different way, and that's maybe has left. So I would be it would have been good to have engaged that a little bit more. I did for the first time travel to Israel and Palestine this last spring. That was a very enlightening experience for me. You cannot be in Jerusalem but be very, very moved by that experience and recognizing its central importance for the three Abrahamic faiths.
One of the things that I was hoping to talk with you about is the work that you have done and the denomination in general has done in conflict resolution. So let's just kind of segue into this. Is the Mennonite tradition at all at work in ongoing peacemaking initiatives between Israelis and Palestinians? Do you know of any efforts along those lines?
The The Mennonite Church has several aspects or several ways to be involved in global peacemaking. One of them is through our aid and development agency called the Mennonite Central Committee, which does have a presence in Israel-Palestine. And along with Christian peacemaker teams, and a number of Mennonites serve regularly in those delegations. These are opportunities for accompaniment, for being present, and for being sure to convene dialogues. The Mennonites would say that dialogue is always a first step, relationships, and also working to ensure our understanding of God's shalom or peace, which includes well-being in all of the ways, including physical well-being. So the reason I mentioned aid and development is that it is very important that people have, you know, shelter and food and medical care, and that their basic needs are met, in order that we also might be developing a sense of the justice that is to come. And again, this is an echo throughout the entire biblical canon. So there is that very significant work. There is a lot of work that also takes place working with local initiatives of the victim offender programs. Our congregation was involved in helping to establish one such here, and we're really looking forward to it was absorbed into a local agency, so that was very important in Champaign-Urbana. We are looking forward to having a speaker in November on the concept of restorative justice.
Would you tell us a little bit about that? Looks very interesting.
Howard Zayer is a professor at Eastern Mennonite University. He co-directs their Center for Justice and Peace Building. And that center is another way in which we're involved in peacemaking, because there are peace practitioners from around the world that come there for advanced study and for a summer institute. Howard has worked for many, many years to help us understand that crime is a violation of people and relationships, and that restoring relationships needs to be part of what is happening. As we know, there's not much attention paid to the victims or victim and offender relationships as a way to have some kind of healing and reparation. Howard has worked, for example, in Oklahoma City after the bombing there. He serves on an advisory board to the Sentencing Commission. He's gotten many, many awards, and he's done some important work with men and women serving life sentences, and a new book called Changing Lenses, A New Focus for Crime and Justice. He's going to be here in Champaign-Urbana between November 6th and 9th. There'll be a lecture at the University of Illinois on Thursday afternoon called Restorative Justice, What It Is, Why It Works, and What It Can Mean for Us, at 4 p.m., and on Saturday, we will have an interfaith workshop about restorative justice as a way of life. So what is it that various faith traditions bring to peacemaking, and how might we use some techniques? What are initiatives that we can put in place? There will be a workshop with local practitioners, and he's going to preach in worship on the 9th. So we're really excited to have him here for these multiple days, and would invite people to visit our website for further information or to email us. And I also have some other information I would be happy to make available to people who email about our peace work.
Just before we forget it, what is that web address?
Our website is www.prairienet.org/Mennonite. Our email address is fmc-cu, that's for First Mennonite Church in Champaign-Urbana, so fmc-cu@sbcglobal.net.
Very good. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the roots, the theological roots of peacemaking activity, which is so central in the Mennonite tradition and certainly locally here. Would you characterize your denomination as pacifist, or is that label not really usable?
We have a very clear statement in our confession about nonviolence, non-resistance, and peacemaking. And so our doctrinal position, you know, we're using that word. That's not a word we use a lot in our context. But our position is that Jesus taught us to love our enemies, to pray for those who persecute us, to love our neighbors, and that this is how we are called to live. We recognize that that is a difficult path. The church in its practice, when I speak of individual members, of course, has struggled with this. Historically, a number of Mennonites have chosen conscientious objection, have participated in alternative service, and that would be the teaching position. I think that's probably the better words now that I'm saying those. That is our teaching position. Historically, the reality is that a number of Mennonites have also served in the military, and that, as we all do, there are times when we find ourselves struggling with these questions. A small book that I found helpful and that I would recommend to listeners is called What Would You Do? by John Howard Yoder. Which is an attempt to answer that question, you know, what would you do if someone burst into your home and was threatening your family? Could you really choose not to exert violence against that person? Mm-hmm. And as Yoder would say there, well, I can't say for sure that I would, but I know that I should. And so recognizing that these are very difficult things, that we would be really called to lay down our own lives before we would take another life, is the teaching position. And that's why we need each other, because this is counter to much of what our culture tells us. And so we need to help support each other in those discussions and recognize that that it's hard. That it's hard. And we talk about the fact that there are hard sayings. Jesus gave us some very hard sayings.
Simplicity in practice, but complexity in thought, right?
Yes. Yep.
Very, very engaging and very attractive stance, I think, for our community. We only have about 8 minutes left. Why don't we talk a little bit about what you're hoping to achieve with your interfaith outreach? We mentioned earlier that you're working with... have been involved with the local mosque across the street from you, or down the street, as you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting that the lay tradition of the Mennonite church, where individuals within the congregation take leadership, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a democratic idea, more strong democratic idea. In the at Simic and at many mosques, the imam emerges from the group. Have you had a chance to talk at all about that, or other areas where there is commonality to explore between those two traditions? And what other work are you hoping to accomplish here in this community along the lines of interfaith dialogue?
A number of members of our congregation are involved with the Interfaith Alliance, and I am just having a chance to get to know that group, as I'm also getting to know people at CIMIC and those involved with the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, and those who are involved across the spectrum, who are connecting into the university campus through the Religious Workers Association and otherwise in the community. So it's still very early for me to say any specifics because, again, those have to emerge from collaboration. But we are hoping with this interfaith workshop on restorative justice to glimpse some ways in which we might, again, link across a broader multiple faith and multiple denominational framework for that, that can be one of our signature initiatives. And we have, as I said, really begun to surface some ideas for actual concrete projects that we might engage together with others like our friends at the mosque. And those, it's just too early for me to say something about that on the air. So,
sure. Yeah. You are brand new, so we should give you a little chance to break in before
thank
we
you.
Put you on the spot
thank
too much.
You.
Now, would you say, in connection with this, that poverty is as much a result of violence as anything else? By violence, I don't mean just physical violence, but violence of ignorance, neglect, policy. How does the church, or how do you think about poverty in general and in this community?
Certainly, I see a connection with we might call it the structural injustices, and it's important to name those as we also think about how we might engage to respond to some root causes. The Mennonites, in this way, see themselves as having some roles to play in looking at questions of policy and activism. We have a we have an office in Washington, D.C., for example, that is involved in monitoring initiatives. This fall, we are in our worship series focusing on the theme of bread. Thinking about it from two perspectives, in the spiritual sense of Jesus as the bread of life, and also bread justice, what it means for us that we are to share. Mm-hmm. We are to share from our largesse with others and ensure that no one goes hungry. So for us, there is a twofold dimension that we have to look at, both the individual response and the question of policies.
Don't we just have a few seconds left here? Are you troubled by the lack of discussion at the national level between the presidential candidates about poverty?
I would wish that we would really that we would address that, and we'll see. I guess one of the upcoming debates might be the forum for that.
And the church attempts to influence public policy at that level.
At the level of the legislative level, certainly there has been some interaction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us. It's a very enjoyable discussion. We've been talking with Pastor Janet Rasmussen, who is the brand new pastor at the First Mennonite Church here in Champaign. Thank you for being with us this afternoon on Keeping the Faith. Steve will be back next week. Goodbye.